Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Now in depth on the pressure to be happy. I had a big case of mental whiplash as I pondered Ruth Whipman's new book. Even as I read how our quest to universal happiness is creating a lot of high anxiety, I was listening to a new podcast about the making of Oprah, the woman, the TV personality, the queen of mindfulness. Here's a little bit of what I heard.
The Oprah Winfrey Show had become an essential part of American feminine identity. Here you had a successful woman in charge of her own show, controlling her own message to a huge audience, a powerful woman who told women to be empowered and get in touch with their feelings.
So you see the challenge here, right? If I can't attain Oprah's standard of happiness, I must not be living my best life. So much pressure. Ruth Whipman, who is British, it should be noted, writes, "It seems as though happiness in America has become the overachiever's ultimate trophy. A modern trump card, it outranks professional achievement and social success, family, friendship, even love." As Ruth Whipman joins us, I want to hear from you. Is Ruth right that there's a lot of social pressure to pursue and attain happiness, but maybe you're content with being something different than happy? What is that, if it isn't happiness? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Ruth Whipman is a writer and the author of the new book, America the Anxious, How Our Pursuit of Happiness is Creating a Nation of Nervous Wrecks. And she joins us from Berkeley, where everybody's happy in Berkeley, California. Aren't they, Ruth?
Absolutely. Nothing bad ever happens here in Berkeley.
I thought it was interesting that you discovered that this urgency to attain some vision of happiness crosses a lot of economic and class lines. And I think you note this about Oprah, that her audience is not made up of a bunch of elites who have nothing better to do than think about why they're not happy. A lot of different people buy into this.
Absolutely. I mean, when we first moved here, I'm from the UK, as you can probably tell from my accent.
Yes, we can.
And we moved to California. And pretty quickly, I noticed that I was having the same conversation over and over again, where people were talking about happiness and all the different things they were doing to become happier and all the methods they were trying and all these wrestling with these big questions about how happy they were. And as you say, at first, I thought, well, is this just a kind of privilege thing that only kind of high income people have the time or the money to worry about? But when I started looking into it, absolutely, it's something, it's a thing that really trickles down all the way through American society. And Oprah's audience, as you say, is not a high income audience generally. And this message is coming through loud and clear that happiness is down to you and you've got to work hard to get it.
Did you discover that happiness is really in the eye of the beholder, or do we share some common sense of what it is to be happy and that we're all questing for that?
That's interesting. I mean, I think different cultures do view happiness in different ways. And in America, I think our expectations of what happiness should look like are very, very high. And some might say even unrealistic. I mean, in this country, we tend to set the bar incredibly high for what happiness should be. It's this kind of blissful. It's a bit like a kind of ashram crossed with a Barbie dream house, crossed with Disneyland. You know, something really amazing that perhaps we're never quite going to achieve. But I think there are some commonalities in how human beings, all human beings, do find happiness. And, you know, what the research and what common sense really tells us about what the genuine paths to happiness are.
Okay, so I want to be clear about what you said. I mean, you said we set the bar rather high, and it does sound like there are some qualities of our idea of happiness that we share. So what is it? Like a sense of serenity? I mean, when we dream of what it is to be happy, what is it that we actually dream of, we Americans?
I think that people don't even really know. I think that people think about happiness and they imagine it as this incredible state that one day they'll achieve if they just do another thing, try another thing, you know, just read another book or do another meditation seminar, whatever it is, then suddenly there will be this blissful nirvana. But I don't think anyone has quite defined what that actually looks like. And I think we're quite bad predictors of the things that will make us happy. You know, I think that, you know, we see it in this kind of abstract way as this happy ever after, but I think we don't really know what the actual elements of that are and how we kind of get there. And I think that's quite a different question. You know, the way we view it and the way we imagine it in our wildest dreams is probably quite different from the actual practical steps that really achieve happiness.
I mean, I would say that part of the pleasure, and you would say anxiety, of pursuing happiness is that it is aspirational, and that that when we capture it, maybe we capture it just in moments. I don't think it would be so enjoyable if we lived in a constant state of happiness. That's me. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think that in order to live a psychologically healthy and meaningful life, we need to acknowledge that there is a spectrum of human emotion.
Right.
We cannot be happy all the time. And we wouldn't want to be, as you say. I mean, to live a meaningful life, we need to acknowledge that, you know, both positive and negative emotions have a value and they tell us things. And when I was writing the book, that was something that came across again and again. When I would go to certain situations and travel to see certain people, when I was in cultures or situations where people were under a great deal of pressure to be happy, it made them very anxious. And when people felt the pressure that they couldn't acknowledge negative emotions, they almost started to feel shame about the very real emotions that they were feeling.
We'll come back to that because, boy, your experience in that Zappos-created landscape. Yeah. Oh, my God. I didn't even know that existed.
It's quite something.
Let's come back to that. Yeah. Leslie says on Twitter, happiness is fleeting. We should accept all emotions as they arise, kind of what you're saying, Ruth. As they serve a purpose, this leads to contentment. And to the phones to Jason in Minneapolis. So, Jason, how do you think about happiness and what it is?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted a quick comment on what she was just saying about not needing to just be happy. I see that with my 3-year-old son where, he just kind of flips the switch to try to be happy. I have to tell him it's okay to be sad. So I see that even saying at that age. But for me, how I see happiness, kind of two parts. One is, you know, I think of it lately a lot as just cumulative to our experience and also really dependent on our physiology, you know, the chemicals that happen and how that informs how your body's interpreting experience.
Yeah.
And the things that you can do around that with diet, sleep, all that stuff.
Yeah, I think
that's such
a great point, Jason. Yeah.
Yeah. The other side is just setting goals, pursuing goals, and getting things in place to feel engaged and find meaning.
Yeah. Your phone's cutting out a little bit, Jason. I think we have the essence of what you want to say. Ruth, I like where Jason is saying it's the mind-body experience here. Here's the other thing. I think that, you know, we'll head for this mirage of contentment, and it will have nothing to do with all the hard work you have to do to bring your body along with that, right? But that's kind of the truth of it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's an excellent point. I think there's a lot of research that shows that people have a predetermined genetic set point when it comes to happiness. So everyone has a kind of vague range of happiness that they work around, and that different things will affect it in certain ways. But yeah, I think each of us has our own happiness range that we probably can't alter a huge amount. That's not to say that things don't alter it a bit and that our circumstances and our own efforts can play a role in that. But yes, there is a mind-body connection there, absolutely.
There's a tweet here from a listener who said he was talking about being present. Here's Nick. He says, for me, happiness is when I can simply be present and kind to myself when I mess up. It's both the journey and the destination. Now, I thought that was amusing because you write about this idea of happiness and being present. I wanted you to hear something. I had a conversation with a Mayo Clinic physician who wrote the Mayo Clinic Guide to Happiness. And here's what he said, Ruth, about the idea of being present. Listen.
We talk a lot about being in the present moment. It is almost impossible to be in the present moment. And many times when I share this with patients, they just look at me with a sense of relief because we've been trying this. Because any species that has imagination, intellect, and has to take care of babies can't be completely in the present moment. What we are trying to do is to be intentional about how you engage with the moment, be it present, past, or future. So when you intentionally engage with this, focusing more on gratitude and compassion, and you engage with the moment as you choose to be, then it doesn't matter whether it is past, present, or future. And so I would like to dissolve this whole concept of, you know, thinking about the future. Just be intentional and you'll find your resilience and happiness.
So what do you think of that, Ruth?
I think it's an excellent point. I mean, I actually, funnily enough, wrote an article that was in the New York Times this weekend past. And it said, the title was, actually, let's not be in the moment. Because I think...
I saw that.
We have this huge pressure at the moment on this idea of mindfulness, of being in the present moment, living in the moment. And that can be an added pressure. And as your guest said, the past, the future, the imagination, reminiscing, the abstract thinking, critical thinking, all of those things are wonderful aspects of the human brain, which we should be enjoying rather than denying. And I think heaping on all this pressure, you know, I've got to be in the present moment, I've got to be in the present moment, can sometimes feel like another chore.
Call here from Tom in Bemidji. Hi, Tom. How do you think about happiness?
Oh, a great many things. I think it's a very complicated issue.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that is missed in most of these discussions is that if your culture doesn't have parenting practices that nurture happy children, they'll project those infantile needs into adulthood, and they'll never truly be happy people. They may try to compensate by having a lot of possessions or whatever pursuits they're trying to, through which they're trying to achieve happiness.
Yeah.
But if they aren't happy as infants, they won't be happy as adults.
Ruth, what do you think of that idea?
It's interesting. I actually wrote a whole chapter in the book, America the Anxious, about parenting techniques and how we approach our children's happiness. And I think that there's a kind of paradox here, because I think over the last 10, 20 years, parents are increasingly obsessed even with our children's happiness. I know I am. It's almost I feel that I can't let my children have negative experiences. You know, they have their every moment has to be magical and wonderful, and I have to be very intensely kind of micromanaging their happiness at all times. But actually, that kind of hovering helicopter parenting that I think many of our generation has been involved in really doesn't lead to happier outcomes long term. And there was some quite scary research that I came across while I was writing the book, which said that the current generation of college students, which were the first generation to be parented in this quite intense way, are showing similar levels of anxiety to psychiatric patients in the 1950s.
Wow.
So I think however much we are focusing on our children's happiness, we're somehow not quite getting it right.
You know, Ruth, the other part of that, we did a show not too long ago about parent shaming. I think that there's an element of that in this too. You know, just this kind of one-upsmanship between parents of my child is so happy that she can do this, this, and that. You know, those kinds of things. Maybe there's a keeping up with the Joneses element of this in parenting, in, you know, among your work colleagues, that we're all trying to one-up each other on how deliriously happy we are.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the research on parenting and happiness is really interesting because consistently we're finding that people with kids are less happy than people without kids. And, you know, this really cuts across class and race and gender. And it's quite a sort of consistent and strong finding. And I think it's absolutely to do with the culture that we're parenting in. I mean, the shelves are just full of parenting books that we're being told 1,000 different things. And there is this competitive element to it. We're sort of parenting, it's become a verb, you know, this idea to parent rather than just, you know, be with our kids and enjoy their company and do what parents have always done. You know, we kind of feel that we have to have a philosophy. And it's very difficult for parents to navigate. There's a lot of pressure on parents nowadays, and there is a lot of competition and shaming between people.
Ruth Whitman is with us, if you've just tuned in, and we're having a fun discussion here about her book, America the Anxious, How Our Pursuit of Happiness is Creating a Nation of Nervous Wrecks. And I'm asking you now, as you hear this conversation develop and we talk about different phases of our life and how this idea of having to be happy fits into that, do you feel like there's a lot of social pressure to pursue and attain happiness? You know, maybe you're content with being something different than happy. So what is that quality? And you know, when you talk about that and within your circle of friends or family, do you then feel that kind of anxiety? But you're not happy. How do you deal with that? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR, where Chad says, yes, this is a spiritual problem. We seek happiness and not joy. We seek material, not spiritual. We think faith is a feeling so wrong. And step off the page.
Molly says, I pursue usefulness. I want to be a useful member of my community and my family. Vacuuming may not make me happy, but I'm content in the fact that I'm doing something necessary.
Okay, so usefulness and contentment, Ruth, can they stand in, do you think, for happiness? Should they?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot wrapped up in this, because sometimes people say to me, you know, happiness isn't important. Do you think that we should just give up on happiness altogether? And I don't quite think that. I think instinctively people want to be happy, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's something that we want at such a deep level. My issue is about the pressure we're putting on ourselves to find it and how we're going about it, if that makes sense. So, yes, absolutely. Contentment, usefulness. And I think the usefulness is a really important part of this, because it's about just living a life where you're outward looking, where you're doing useful, meaningful and connected things, and let the happiness kind of hitch a ride rather than making that the goal in and of itself.
I think Melissa on Twitter here really has something. She says, Instagram is the new face of happy. In the last year, I got an article published, a house, a promotion. I'm still seeking happiness. Yeah, Ruth, what you said about social media, wow. You say happiness is the currency of social media and the loophole in the generally accepted no bragging rule. You are so right. All you have to do is start noticing all the superlatives that pop up on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Why are we that way in that world, in a way that we wouldn't be in one-on-one personal interactions? You really made me think about that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, if I write a chapter about this in the book, about it's called I'm Not a Happy Person, I Just Play One on Facebook.
Right.
And it's this idea that all of us, you know, we put forward this blissfully happy image on Facebook and Instagram. And it's kind of, it's like an arms race. We're all raising the stakes all the time about how happy we look. And, you know, we post, and I do it myself, you know, that I have this example of how a few weeks ago we went apple picking with our kids in a nearby orchard. And frankly, it was kind of a miserable day. You know, the kids were whining the whole time. It was so hot we could barely move. The apples were heavy. Half of them were rotten. But yet my Facebook picture of that day was the one sort of millisecond where both kids were smiling and no one needed to go to the bathroom and nobody was complaining. And that was what was shared on Facebook. And probably everybody looking at that would look at that day and think that I had this blissful time. And so we're raising the stakes constantly for our expectations of what happiness should look like. You know, is it a beautiful Instagram brunch with a very glamorous woman that, you know, that probably took 2 hours to construct, you know? And I think that social media really does put a huge pressure on us to expect our levels of happiness to be quite unrealistic.
Okay, Ruth, what would happen, though, if you really got real on Facebook and said, here's the picture of the one moment when everybody was happy? I think it would be a breath of fresh air on Facebook, right?
Yeah. I think it really would. I mean, there's been some scattered attempts to try to be more honest on Facebook and social media, but they never seem to catch on. And it's quite hard to know why. I think it would be a huge breath of fresh air. And, you know, I used to say that when we first moved to the United States, I could tell instantly, you know, you could blindfold me and read out the Facebook updates of my friends. And I could tell you instantly which ones were British and which ones were American, because the American ones were all feeling blessed. My husband's the hottest guy ever, and my kids are the cutest ever, and everything's wonderful and feeling so grateful. And my British ones would be all, you know, I'm waiting for a bus in the rain and it's rubbish and, you know, everything's terrible. But as we've been here, actually, the British have become way more like the Americans, and everybody's doing this same kind of global happiness.
Oh, no.
And, you know, actually, that in and of itself, I quite like those slightly surly British updates in my Facebook feed. They make me feel a lot better about myself.
This must be why I love being in London, exactly for that reason. call here from Mary in Minnetonka. Hey, Mary, you want to talk about Facebook? Hey, Mary, are you there? Hi. Uh-oh, we might have lost her. To Rebecca in North Dakota. Hi, Rebecca. What are you thinking about?
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
This topic is great. I love it. When I heard your guest talk about the helicopter parenting, and I don't know if it has to do with the fact that my husband and I are older parents. We're both almost 50, and, you know, our kids range from 6 to 12.
Uh-huh.
And we have a pretty good group of helicopter parents in our, you know, the grades that our kids are in. And we just figured it out. We decided, okay, great. They get everything started. We're all about the bars. Tell us what you need us to bring. We'll be there. But, you know, and it is the easiest. Once I clued into that, it was just like the easiest parenting tip I give. And I also noticed that the kids of those helicopter parents are really not very nice people. I don't want to like put our kids on pedestals, but just the other day, again, someone came up to us and said, your 12-year-old is such a great kid. It's such a pleasure to have him in class. You know, more kids should be like him. He's so great, and he's so helpful, and he's so nice.
Rebecca, you better get on Facebook and say that, right?
You know what? That is probably the key. He will not let me post anything about him. He's like, Christmas pictures and birthday pictures. That's all you get to put out on me.
You know,
so maybe that's the key, too.
Rebecca, when you said we're all about the bars, I thought for a minute, and I've been in Minnesota for a long time, but I thought for a minute you meant like the bars.
No.
I know what you mean.
As soon as I said that, I thought, that was the wrong thing to say. But we're like, you get everything started. We will just tell us what to bring. Tell us, I can always bring a pan of bars.
We'll bring the cookie bars, yeah. Ruth, what do you think about this idea that maybe maturity, you know, is part of looking at happiness in a more realistic way, especially when it comes to parenting? I think that's what our listeners are saying there.
I mean, I think that's a great point. There's quite a bit of research that says that people in the second half of their lives, you know, the over 55s, are actually the happiest group in society. And I think a lot of that does have to do with a certain wisdom that comes with being older and this idea that you're not constantly striving for something that you might never achieve, and you've accepted life as it is, and that you've kind of been around the block and know that there's a range of emotions and a range of things, and things come back round again. And I think that wisdom does come with age. I'm waiting to find out.
Jane says on Twitter, I like seeing fun and funny on Facebook. I don't like hearing about someone's cold or their tooth extraction, etc. Step off the page.
Jerry says, happiness is simplistic. It's more of a spice than an entree, so to speak. I believe being at ease with oneself, no matter what is going on or how you're feeling, is a better pursuit.
You know, we had that show yesterday about grace. See, that's what I think I'd rather inhabit. Ruth, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. I would rather possess fleeting moments of grace than happiness. I think there's more fulfillment in that.
Yeah, I think that's a really lovely way of putting it. And I think it's just this thing about trying so hard. I mean, I think that if what you're doing is just living a life where you're connected and engaged in meaningful things and following what interests you and doing good things for other people, then you will have a graceful and gracious life and the happiness will follow along.
Right.
But I think this kind of intense and, you know, slightly overwrought pursuit is where the anxiety comes in.
A call here from Anne in Plymouth. Hi, Anne.
Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for waiting.
So I used to work at the happiest place on earth. Any guesses where that is?
Disney World, right?
Disney World. And it was such an irony because you see Disney World as like this is the happiest and perfect family vacation. It's going to be the best thing ever. And then you get there and you see the families and they're just miserable. And working there, I was happy to be working there. I really enjoyed what I did, but I would just see the families that were like, they plan this perfect trip and they're going to make it the best ever. And by gall, no matter what happens, we're not going to, you know, we're not going to have unhappy children. And we're tired and we just want to go back to the hotel and take a nap, but we paid all this money to be happy together. Darn it, we're going to be happy together. And I find this so funny because,
oh my God,
you know,
Anne, that's great.
You talk to people when they come back and they're like, oh, yeah, it was wonderful.
It was great.
They don't remember that whole miserable afternoon. They just remember overall being like, yeah, it was really fun and great. But this is one of those things where this, you know, America with anxiety, like this is one of the things
that we
project
exactly.
as anxious.
You know, I want to know, if, Steph, were you listening to that or were you
I was.
Going back and forth? How many times have you been to Disney? Is it World or Land
Disney World
with your kids?
Is where my family goes.
How many times?
Three times.
Okay. Didn't the last one you came back and you said to me,
yeah.
It was so hot and we stood in all these lines. And,
yeah. But you know what? It's like any vacation, though. There are bad things that happen at the time and then you think back. And last week I was just thinking, gosh, remember how much fun we had at Disney World? So I get the same feeling. About
I wonder.
All vacations
I wonder if
like
Ruth
that.
Knows why do we do that, Ruth? Why do we? You know, why are we invested in the idea of looking back and, you know, with rose-colored glasses about things?
Well, you know, it's funny. This comes back to this whole thing about being in the moment. I mean, I think you just summed it up perfectly because actually sometimes in the moment, things aren't that great. But when you look back, you know, not in the moment, things seem a lot rosier. And so maybe it's this idea of embracing the past, the present, the future, all the different things that our minds can do. And I agree. I think I do exactly the same thing, that you edit out the bad bits and you look back. And, you know, when I talk to my mom about being a parent of toddlers, she just cannot remember. It's the way she talks about me as a toddler. I never had a tantrum. I always took a long nap every day. I was completely well behaved at all times. And, you know, and I think this cannot be true. But, you know, that's how she remembers it.
This is a conversation about the social pressure to be happy. Ruth Whitman is with us. We're talking about her book, America the Anxious. And it's this idea that we feel this pressure via social media, via our one-on-one interactions. It's this idea that I think of as kind of keeping up with the Joneses. If you're happy, I've got to be happier. And I'm asking you, as you listen into this, if you feel that social pressure, and if you've kind of, you've come to a place where it isn't so much about happiness, it's about some other quality. I said to Steph a few minutes ago that after having that conversation yesterday about grace, that's really more what I think I'm going to put my energies into, attaining more grace and forget the happiness. And how do you feel about that? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, of course on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Back in just a minute here, but a look at the latest news. And Phil, what are you watching this hour?
Hi, Carrie. Rain is moving through a Tennessee tourism region ravaged by wildfires, but officials there say that the fires are still active in the area. The Gatlinburg area got up to an inch of rain overnight, and forecasters say the rain will pick up through this afternoon. The State Emergency Management Agency says any rain will help, but the fires are still an ongoing situation. During wildfires Monday night, many buildings in Gatlinburg were burned to the foundation. Four people were killed. The fire destroyed at least 150 buildings, including iconic homes and a resort. Storm-spawned tornadoes are suspected in the deaths of five people in Alabama last night. The president-elect's pick for Treasury Secretary says federal spending on roads and bridges will be a big priority for the administration. Speaking to reporters in Trump Tower today, Steve Mnuchin said the country needs infrastructure that is built for the 21st century. Donald Trump emphasized infrastructure investment throughout his campaign, and Mnuchin said the administration will work with Congress to figure out how to pay for this effort. Trump says the presidency is far more important than what he calls his great business empire. He tweeted documents are in the works that will take him completely out of business operations. He had been criticized for potential conflicts if he kept his role in his global businesses while serving as the U.S. president. Trump says he and his children will hold a news conference on the subject in about 2 weeks. The judge in the murder trial of a white former South Carolina patrolman who fatally shot a black motorist says he will let the jury consider a lesser charge of manslaughter in that case. Michael Slager is charged in the 2015 shooting death of Walter Scott as Scott fled from a traffic stop. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:36.
I'm Tom Weber. More people die from addiction overdoses, including opioid and alcohol abuse each year. More than cancer, heart disease, and diabetes combined. Next hour on NPR News, a look at some of the stark numbers. Join us at 11.
Support for this program comes from Hennepin Health Foundation's Light Up the Night Gala on December 2nd. This fundraising event supports the mission of HCMC, where every life matters. Learn how you can join the celebration on the field of U.S. Bank Stadium at hcmc.org/light.
You've heard me mention the title of the book that we're talking about today a couple of times. You can find and read about all of the books that I'm reading and Steph's reading and Tracy Mumford is reading on the thread, nprnews.org/thread. Ruth Whitman back with us, and the name of the book is America the Anxious. And a call here from Stephanie in southwest Minnesota. Hey, Stephanie, thanks for waiting.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what are you thinking about?
Well, I'm 33, and I think I have people my age that were kind of the beginning of the helicopter parenting.
Yeah.
And I think they are mis-equating happiness and contentment as one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like people need to realize that happiness is moments, and they happen, and you feel euphoric, but you can't feel that way all the time.
Right.
And I don't think enough focus is put on learning how to be content in the moment, and even if that's when you're unhappy, still understanding that you can still strive for new and greater things while being content, and that being content doesn't mean you're going to be complacent.
That is
two very different things.
Really well said. Ruth, I love this idea that Stephanie is bringing up about contentment, even in moments that are difficult, that you wouldn't, you know, describe as happy.
Yeah, I mean, there's some interesting research on that. There's two ways that academics and researchers measure happiness. And one of them is this overall feeling of life satisfaction, contentment, when you take everything as a whole. And the other is this moment to moment, how am I feeling literally right now? And those two types of happiness work completely independently of each other. So you can have many, many moments where you're annoyed or irritated or, you know, you hate your husband or whatever. But if somebody asked you your overall levels of happiness, then you might well be very content or happy. And vice versa. People can have many, many pleasurable moments, but still not consider themselves happy in an overall sense. So, yes, I think we need to sort of take a wider perspective and a long view. So it doesn't really matter what's happening in any individual moment, but work on the kind of as a whole, what is meaningful in our lives.
Okay, so do you think that's the thing that the founder of Zappos really didn't understand?
So just to backtrack a bit, I mean, Zappos is an online shoe store, and the founder of the company, the CEO of the company, Tony Hsieh, is obsessed with this idea of happiness. He has a company called Delivering Happiness. He has a bus that he drives around with giving out balloons and messages of happiness and joy. The workplace is all, you know, balloons and parades and fireworks and out-of-hours drinking and, you know, a constant stream of kind of party, party, party. And he's also set up this thing. So that's his company. And then he's also bought up this 60 acres of land in downtown Las Vegas and is running it as a kind of happiness community where you know, about innovation and creativity and bringing entrepreneurs in and running it on all these models. And I think absolutely this, and I go there in the book and I spend some time there and see this community. And there are many, many pressures on people there. And, you know, I won't tell you too much about it, but one spoiler, in this happiness community, tragically, they had a spate of suicides, in part because of this pressure on people. And I think that, yes, what Tony Hsieh perhaps doesn't understand or doesn't embrace is this idea that we have that happiness on its own, the pressure to be happy, can cause real anxiety in people.
Yeah, I think what we learn is that in that situation is that people felt they didn't feel free to be honest about, you know, the feeling that that contentment was out of their reach, that happiness was out of their reach. And there was great pressure to, you know, if you weren't happy in that moment, you were going to be happy 2 minutes later, right? And to put on this false face about
this happy front. And I think that's a huge theme throughout people that I saw throughout the book. I also spent some time with the Mormons in Utah, which is completely opposite kind of thing, but another community where there's a very strong pressure to be happy, to look happy, and to appear happy. And in both situations, people felt this real pressure and just felt like they couldn't quite admit to negative emotions, even though all human beings have negative emotions. We all feel unhappy or miserable or depressed or unsettled or anxious at certain points. And if you can't admit to it, I think that pressure can be very anxiety-inducing.
Jen says, I think gratefulness is better to seek than happiness. Happiness will naturally follow if you're thankful for what you have. We haven't really talked about gratitude, but it's a good point. Steph, off the page.
Hugh likes cooking. He says, food creates the best culture, not consuming sports. Be a doer, not a watcher. Any pursuit that requires diligence and self-betterment contributes to happiness. I mentioned food because it's something we can all share.
And you said you had quite a conversation.
Yeah, we've been going back
to the page about,
because we're talking about what we've cooked lately. I made matzo ball soup this weekend. I was immensely
you were
pleased.
Happy.
I was immensely pleased with myself and felt very accomplished.
Jesse says on Twitter, "Yes, I lost my husband 3 years ago, and I'm always thinking of the joy that we had, and not the negative things." And to the phones to Brittany in Brooklyn Park. Hi, Brittany.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. That's the American thing, Ruth. Did you hear that? How are you? No, how are you? And you feel like you have to say fine, even if you're not.
I'm sorry, right.
Brittany. I got off on a tangent there. Brittany, go ahead.
I was just going to say that I actually just like to feel alive. So I don't necessarily always want to be happy. I just want to feel like I'm alive. So I actually embrace all of my emotions that I have.
It's good. So does that mean, Brittany, like in interactions with a casual friend, you don't feel pressured to be like, no, everything's good, you know, because you just don't want to get into it?
Well, most of the time, everything is pretty good for me. I don't know. I don't hide when there's something bad. Like, I will say it's not so good right now.
Okay, good. Thanks for the call to Lucy in Mendota Heights. Hi, Lucy. How are you thinking about this?
Well, I was just driving home from my morning workout, and I was listening to the program, and I recently retired, and I just, one of my comments was that there is a tendency when you have a lifestyle change like that for people to project upon you what you're supposed to be doing to have a good life.
I totally get this.
And it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen when you're in the workplace, of course, and nobody tells you to do anything. But when you do that, all of a sudden you're supposed to have a condo in Florida and you're supposed to travel and you're supposed to do all these things. And recently my husband and I did do a trip to the Baltic and we enjoyed it, but I don't think it was the be all and end all. I mean, you know, so I would just kind of caution people that, you know, you have to kind of follow your own barometer about what it is that you want. And there is a tendency at this stage of life to really kind of browbeat people. I mean, you know, so anyway, that was my comment.
No, Lucy, this is really good because Ruth, I think she's got something. When you retire, there's this presumption among we who are still working that your life is just glorious every moment of the day. And people want you to confirm that to them, right?
Yeah, and I think people project their own insecurities and their own yeah. desires and their own things onto other people. And I love that word that your caller used, browbeat. I mean, yeah. I think that's really true. You must be doing this and you must be doing that and it must be great. And, you know, actually, people are different. You know, some people love to travel and do all of this and some people love to stay home. And you know, not every moment has to be great. And I think that very unrealistic image of this, you know, blissful 20, 30 years of retirement. Let's just sort of dial it back a little bit and think, you know, retirement is going to have its own joys and challenges just like every other stage of life.
Craig says, I seek peace and gratitude. Cultivate happiness with gratitude. Every pleasure, every pain, each mundane event is an opportunity. He does sound very zen. He must be a meditator. Steph, off the page.
Liz says, I'm an early 40s parent of a toddler, and we're trying to figure out this crazy journey.
Oh, boy.
I'm baffled at the amount of energy people put into posting their happiness when we can barely survive getting dinner on the table. I know those posts can't be real life. I'm convincing myself that most people are faking it.
That makes her feel better, I'm sure. To the phones to Bob in St. Paul. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
You know, I'm recently retired, so I'm not going to try to put too much pressure on myself here. But
good.
When I was a little kid, I remember if I was sick, I just felt like I was going to be sick forever. If my friend wasn't available to play, I thought I was just going to be despondent and be bored forever. And by being older, you have a frame of reference. And so I just think it's a function of just appreciate a good day. And not always look to being, you know, the younger folks are always seem more joyful and maybe generally happier. I vote for just more of a contentment and just being, you know, more even.
You know, I'm really, thank you, Bob. I'm wondering what Ruth thinks about, because we're hearing all these callers who are so centered and smart about this, Ruth. They're kind of the antithesis of the America the Anxious that you're writing about. Do you believe it?
You know, it's interesting. I think, and I feel like this myself, you know, I make these pronouncements about what it takes to be happy. But in any given moment, you know, I'm just as neurotic as anybody else. And, you know, I have just as many difficult moments. And I think that's the thing. I think when we're thinking about things in the abstract, it's very easy to, you know, take the heat out of it and to philosophize about it. And then day by day, things are often more challenging for all of us. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, my book, America the Anxious, it's not suggesting that everybody in America is a complete nervous wreck. I think it's just something, a kind of cultural thing, that there is a kind of cultural anxiety about happiness in this country.
So a few minutes ago, you said that when you first moved to the United States and someone would read you Facebook posts aloud, you could tell which were your American friends and which were your British friends. And then you said it sounded like your British friends were becoming more, you know, they were feeling more pressure to
yes.
one-up each other on happiness. I mean, what's going on with that, do you think?
So I think the spread of this kind of happiness, positivity culture has really kind of gone global. And I think, you know, it's partly the self-help industry. It's partly just a kind of, you know, we live in a global world and social media, you know, we all know people from different countries. And I think the tone has just been set that's what's what. I mean, one of your previous callers said, I don't want to see miserable stuff on Facebook and I don't want everyone whining about everything.
Right.
And I agree with that. You know, I don't think that everybody wants everything to be utterly miserable all the time or the thing would be a downer. I think there's a balance in there, isn't there, between kind of out and out bragging and completely curating everything to be unrealistic and just, you know, and making everybody miserable all the time. I think it's got to be about balance and some honesty there.
Have you ever watched the BBC series W1A? Steph Curtis turned me on to it. Have you ever seen it, Ruth?
The one about the BBC?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So
I used to work at the BBC, so it's very, very.
Is it true?
Oh, my goodness, it's so true. I actually had to stop watching after the first episode because it was so true that I could just cringe. I couldn't even enjoy it. It was just like, you know, watching a reel of my own life.
Okay, for our listeners that don't know what I'm talking about, it's a BBC series called W1A. And here's why I bring it up. These people sit in these meetings, these large meetings, and no one wants to make anybody else unhappy. So, you know, it's the most passive aggressive group you have ever seen. Yes, more than Minnesota, by the way. So people, like, they harbor these grudges and these opinions, but nobody ever wants to really say it out. And so I was wondering, Ruth, if you think the British are more passive aggressive just as a whole. than Americans. Are they?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a wonderful directness in American culture, which I love. And, you know, that usually, I mean, these things are generalizations. There's obviously differences within individuals. But I think broadly speaking, when you talk to American, what they're saying is roughly what they mean, and they can be direct. Whereas I think in British culture, there's all these codes and tripwires, and somebody says, you know, I mean, take the phrase with the greatest possible respect, which sounds on the face of it like you respect somebody. But the phrase with the greatest possible respect means, I think you're an idiot.
pretty
roughly translated.
That's right. Yeah. Pretty much signals, this is what I'm really thinking, but I'm never going to say it to you.
Yes, exactly.
Step off the page.
Mark reminds us of pop culture past. He says, remember the 1960s TV show The Prisoner? Everybody in the village except number 6 was very happy.
Really? No, yeah. I don't remember that.
It was a really good show. And then Crystal says, I long ago discovered there is so much more joy in the journey than the destination.
Uh-huh. And to the phones to Lisa in Redwood Falls. Hey, Lisa, how are you thinking about this?
Hey, so I wanted to bring up my own personal philosophy.
Okay, good.
On happiness
good.
Is good mental hygiene, which a lot of people, you know, they'll take care of their bodies, they'll take care of their finances, they'll clean their house, but they won't be responsible for what's going on in their brain. And for me, it's like, you know, we all think negative thoughts or anxious thoughts. And I always say, I'm not responsible for the first one, but I'm responsible for the second one.
Uh-huh.
You know, when a negative thought comes to my head, I can go down that rabbit hole of obsessing. I used to be a very obsessive thinker, you know, where you just like grab hold onto this idea and like worry it to death. And I just, you know, years of practicing, there's that Buddhist meditation called Shempa, where you really practice learning to let go of thoughts. And through that, learning that years ago, my mental hygiene is often just as important as everything else of like, what am I consuming? You know, like lately I've had to like unsubscribe from some political blogs and things because I just need a breather. I need to, you know, clear my headspace and be, you know, just like some people will take care of what they put in their body. We have to be equally aware of what we're putting into our minds and what we're choosing to think about every day.
I really like that. So, Lisa, you are being kind of highly conscious about what you're going to let yourself develop, I guess, in your head.
I think of it as like I see this stream where these fish are going by and there's thoughts and I'll pick one up. And you know how there's certain thoughts you'll just pick up over and over until the fish is like dead and it has like all these hook marks in it. And finally you just have to say, I'm like so sorry. I'm going to let you go and quit picking you back up.
Jeez.
And when you practice that a lot, you know, I've been practicing it for years. I really am completely in charge for the most part of what I choose to think about. Not the first one. We all have intrusive thoughts. But what comes up next? And if I choose to, you know, hang on to that thought or let it go. And I'm often dissatisfied with life. You know, I have lots of ambitions and things I work for. I'm in my early 40s and professional. But I'm not unhappy. It's just like, oh, this is a new challenge I want to explore. And I'm aware I'm very pragmatic. And I'm, you know, you talked about I recently moved to Minnesota and you talked about that passive aggressive. I believe. In clear but kind, you know, I can be kind and also clear. And I sort of treat myself like that, you know, clear but kind thinking.
I'm so glad you heard the show, Lisa. Well, what a great way to close the conversation. Ruth, I think Lisa is going to write the answer book to America the Anxious. What do you think?
Yeah, great. I look forward to reading it.
Hey, really good to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Ruth Whitman's book is called America the Anxious, How Our Pursuit of Happiness is Creating a Nation of Nervous Wrecks. You can read about it on The Thread.